Next case is 97-1650, Cleveland Police Patrolmen's Association versus the City of Cleveland.
I need Sandra to take this and bring it right back.
Mr. D'Angelo.
Patient processing needs a transformation of parts of the system. And a different set of forms. I think this is a part of this.
As the briefs have been submitted, it makes sense to be sure that this is relatively simple.
Thanks.
There was a dispute between the party relative to section 53 of the collective bargaining agreement and the union filed agreements which proceeded to arbitration. The arbitrator ruled in favor of the city and against the union. The union asserted that the arbitrator committed violations of law and failed to discharge his duties pursuant to 2711.10 and filed a motion to vacate before Judge Aurelius in court conference. Judge Aurelius granted the motion to vacate after providing both sides an opportunity to fully brief the matter. The arguments that the sides made are properly set forth in propositions of law number 2 and 3 in the matter before this honorable court. I respectfully submit that the significant issue at hand today is that set forth in proposition of law number 1, which is the jurisdictional issue. Therefore, I find my remarks
closer to
proposition unless the court has questions otherwise. It's the contention of the CCGA that the Court of Appeals committed a reversible error when it failed to follow the dictates of this honorable court in the short case and also failed to follow its decision in the City of Federal Heights case versus FOP and also the Fragment case. The proposition of law that this court enunciated in the Stewart case is that where a trial court judge grants a motion to vacate an arbitration decision and refers the matter back to the arbitrator, that is not a final appealable order. And therefore, in this particular case, it's our assertion that the Court of Appeals committed a reversible error when it reversed the trial court decision, which had referred the matter back to a labor arbitrator, because at that point in time, after the trial court judge granted the motion to vacate, that was not a final appealable order. The City of Cleveland would not have been jeopardized. They still could have gone forward and made their arguments to the arbitrator. The arbitrator could have been in favor of the city or in favor of the union, but it was not a final decision. Again, in the Stewart case decided by this court, the plaintiff in that case had filed a personal injury claim and had alleged that her injuries and her husband's losses to the consortium claim were worth $50,000 pursuant to the policy limit. The matter was referred to arbitration, and the arbitrators, a three-member panel, awarded $45,000. And the appellant, Mrs. Stewart, alleged in her motion to vacate that her husband's consortium claim was not included. Therefore, all the claims were not decided by the arbitrator. Therefore, the motion to vacate was proper. The trial court judge granted the motion to vacate. On appeal, which went up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court held that the matter should go back to an arbitrator and should not be decided by the court because it's not a final appealable order. And we would argue that in this particular case, the trial court judge reversed the arbitrator's decision pursuant to 2711.10 and remanded the matter back to the American Arbitration Association. That matter was not a final appealable judgment, and therefore the Court of Appeals committed error and had reversed that decision. We have clearly a disagreement between the Court of Appeals and the trial court judge as to the arguments made in propositions of law number 2 and 3 relative to the basis for the underlying motion to vacate being granted or denied. But the jurisdictional issue, we believe, is paramount that the Court of Appeals erred in the exercise jurisdiction. We also call to the Court's attention the decision from our Court of Appeals in the City of Bedford Heights case versus the Fraternal Order of Police. In that particular case, a patrol officer had been disciplined and given 30 days suspension without pay and 1 year's probation. The police officer appealed that matter, and a labor arbitrator reversed and simply ordered a verbal reprimand. The matter then went to appeal to the trial court, and the trial court reversed the arbitrator. On appeal to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals for the 8th District ruled that it was not a final appealable order, and therefore they would not exercise jurisdiction as the matter should go back to arbitration. Again, we just submit, using the same reasoning and precedent from this court in the Stewart case, that our Court of Appeals committed a reversible error and accepted jurisdiction for Aetna.
Did the Court of Appeals just ignore Stewart, or how did they address
it? Well, they attempted to distinguish it, Your Honor, by making a statement that the underlying facts in our case involved one claim. That claim had been fully heard and was therefore decided. Therefore, there was nothing else to incur as contrasted to the Stewart case, where there was this issue of a consortium claim or not. We would assert that that's a distinction without a difference. The claim that was made in the Stewart case was for the policy limit of $50,000. From the decision of this honorable court, it doesn't get into who was right or wrong on that issue. It simply refers to a conflicting two affidavits that were filed, one by the dissenter and one by the one of the majority members of the panel. And it does not say what the court's decision as to who was right or wrong. The court simply stated that we would assert that there was one claim that was made in the Stewart case, and that is the claim was worth $50,000. There were two component parts. In our arbitration, we assert that there was one claim, whether the city violated Section 53 of the collective bargaining agreement. There were sub-arguments to be made, but there was one singular claim to be made.
Now, it would appear the trial judge made it just a, I guess I should call it a postcard entry by referring to, then he wrote final on there. Is there any significance to the...
No, we don't believe so. That happens time and time again. That's contrasted with an interlocutory decision. That use of the word final, I believe, is different from the statutory...
Supposedly language.
Yes.
He didn't address, it would appear that the trial judge didn't think this was a final appealable order, since he hadn't addressed any of the issues involving the arbitration, just simply merely sent back, vacated and sent back.
Well, Your Honor, the trial briefs that were filed basically mirrored the arguments that this court has before it and the briefs of the parties in terms of propositions law number 2 and 3 we refer to. And we believe the judge really has found that there was a factual basis for the Lewis claim that the arbitrator violated 27.11.10 and then referred the matter back to the American Arbitration Association for further proceedings, at which case, as in the Stewart case, the referral back to arbitration was on the entire claim, not just the issue of whether the plaintiff was entitled to another $5,000 for loss of consortium claim. It was not considered. The whole issue of $50,000 was still on the table for both the husband and the wife.
So you feel his referral back to the American Arbitration Association reopened the case for their further consideration?
Yes, Your Honor, for both sides. The city could make any and all claims it chose to make, as well as the CPPA.
He didn't say for a new hearing, but he just referred it back. Are we to assume that's what he meant for a new hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, we also need to reflect back to the motion to vacate that the union filed that was assigned to Judge Aurelius, and that motion did not ask for a monetary reward, as the city incorrectly asserts that now this is just simply a matter of calculation, figure out how much is due, and therefore it is a final appeal award. In our motion to vacate, which was fully briefed in the trial court, we asked for another hearing because the arbitrator clearly ignored the arguments and, in essence, nullified Section 53 of the collective bargaining agreement. We did not ask for any monetary reward in our motion to vacate. We just simply asked for an arbitration hearing so that all the issues could be fully litigated.
Stewart wasn't a unanimous case, was it?
I'm not sure if I have that in front of me.
Well, I can tell you it wasn't. Was arbitration known at common law?
No, it's a special statutory procedure.
It's a special statutory procedure. It affects a substantial right?
Well, if there's a final decision, yes, Your Honor. But in this, again, this...
Well, the final decision is to not to arbitrate.
Pardon?
The final decision is to arbitrate or not to arbitrate.
Yes.
Why doesn't that make it final appealable order? I mean, that's why we dissented in that case.
Well, when you phrase it that way, I agree with you, but there's another issue, which is the ultimate issue, and that is, who is right in this particular case, the union or the city, in terms of whether or not the city's conduct violated Section 53 of the collective bargaining.
But that's the merit issue, isn't it?
Yes.
And we're talking about a procedural issue on whether or not this is a final appealable order.
But that procedural issue goes to whether or not the city's substantive rights will be preserved. And again, as in the historic case, in the FOP, City of Bedford Heights case, the Maryland Court of Appeals decided, again, I don't understand how there could be a distinction between that case and the present case, where the trial court had reversed the discipline imposed, and on appeal, the Court of Appeals didn't even consider saying they didn't have the jurisdiction, should go back to the arbitrator. So, for the reasons of we have asserted, we feel that it's very clear that this court should follow the Stewart case, that the attempted distinction in that case by a Court of Appeals basically is a distinction without any real difference, and that no party before the court would be jeopardized in any way. The city would still have its rights to argue its case fully on the merits, as well as the union and the parties would be able to demonstrate why the arbitrator that heard this case initially completely violated his duties. And again, I think it's instructive to read this decision. The labor arbitrator
said... We might as well go to that. I mean, it's your contention that the arbitrator, it sounds like he didn't buy the arguments of the Patrolman's Association. Is that the same as violating the duty to hear the case?
Your Honor, I acknowledge we lost.
Yeah.
Which means that he did not buy our arguments. But I would respectfully submit that if you read his award, the arbitrator said that both sides, the City of Cleveland and the Union, did not even know what Section 53 was. They didn't even know it existed. And there was evidence in the record to dispute that. So,
But there's a very limited ability to appeal an arbitrator's award. This is final and binding arbitration. So what bases do you say you fit under, given that there's very limited statutory bases? Which one do you fit under?
Under subsection D, that the arbitrator has set forth in propositions of law number 2 and 3 of our brief, and perfectly made his decision so that a final decision could not be made. To this date, there still is not a determination as to whether or not, when the city goes beyond the limit of 16 weeks of training, whether or not those members are entitled to any further pay over and above the $8.50 an hour.
Don't you think that arbitration award said that they were not? They're not entitled to it.
Well, he said that they're not entitled to it because they have no right under the contract, even though the recognition section of the contract provides.
But see, isn't that just that you're disagreeing with the decision?
I'm disagreeing, Your Honor, because the arbitrator failed to deal with it head-on. He, in essence, nullified Section 53.
Counsel, isn't that different from Stewart, where the court found it was a failure to consider the loss of consortium altogether?
Your Honor, I think a careful reading of this court's decision would reflect that this court was speculating as to what the lower court had determined. It wasn't clear in the record. The language of this majority opinion used was apparently the lower court concluded that the award was incomplete.
Was there any dispute that the arbitrator here did not have the complete employment contract in front of him or her?
Absolutely did.
So the four corners of the document, which you say control payment or compliance was at least there to be considered.
Yes, as was the insurance contract in the Stewart case.
Does it ever told us of the Stewart case does take any of that into consideration? The trial court's order which vacates an arbitration award orders the party to select new arbitrators and to conduct new arbitration proceedings and not a field award that should be brought.
Yes.
So that's it.
Reserve
remain on that.
Thank you.
There's no. He admitted it. That's what happened wrong. He said it's a special proceeding. It's substantial. And
he said, how do you get around the Stewart? We have to
reverse
Stewart.
Argue with that, huh?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Leslie Milton from City of Cleveland, first of all. And no, you don't have to reverse Stewart because Stewart versus Smith Western is distinguishable from this case.
But that addressed the syllabus is quite broad.
In Stewart versus Smith Western, though, what this court basically stated was that you had an arbitration panel below who could not agree on whether or not they resolved all of the issues in that case. There was a personal injury case, and then there was also a loss of consortium claim as well. The arbitration panel and affidavits couldn't agree as to whether or not they even dealt with the loss of consortium claim. So in that case, the difference is that there wasn't a final appealable award because they had not dealt with all of the claims. And Justice Douglas' dissent in that case is on point for this case, which is basically what you have here, is a case involving a special proceeding and also involving a substantial right of the city. Here what you have is arbitration award that was vacated by the trial court. The trial court vacated that award pursuant to a statute. And what this court said in its case of Holocaust versus Adams is that you can define a special proceeding based on the fact that it's not based in common law and based on the fact that it's a statutory matter and it's created by statute. I would submit that Ohio Revised Code 2711 is a statute, in fact, that the court has to review an arbitration award. And therefore, that award was reviewed pursuant to a special proceeding. Also, this court said in Polkoff that if you have a trial court order that's made within the confines of a special proceeding and also affects a substantial right, then those are the elements needed for a final appealable order. The city has a substantial right in this case. I can embellish on the facts just a little. I will explain why the city has a substantial right.
You're right about all that. You're right about what the dissent in Stewart says, but the dissent isn't the law. The dissent is not just like a purported concurrence to a majority decision doesn't necessarily say what the majority decision says. The majority decision speaks for itself. In this case, the dissent, while correct maybe, isn't the law. The law is it's not a final appealable order. Isn't that what it says?
Well, that was the dissent in Stewart. I would suggest to you, Justice Douglas.
No, the majority decision in Stewart says that a vacating of an arbitration award is not a final appealable order. Isn't that what it says?
That is correct.
Isn't that what happened here?
No, that is not what happened here. I would suggest that the court look at its decision in Bell versus Mount Sinai Medical Center, which was decided later in time than the Stewart case. And in that case, you did find that there was a special proceeding because it had to do with a statute based on prejudgment interest, and there was a substantial right involved, and therefore you did decide that it was a final appealable order, and that's what I'm suggesting in this case.
And the court may look at the syllabus law in terms of the underlying case. That's your argument here, that the underlying case can be argued to when you apply it with the syllabus. You have some distinction. You think there's a distinction there?
I'm not sure I understand.
Midwestern. Are you trying to distinguish Midwestern?
Well,
We're telling you the syllabus doesn't help you that much. But you're saying the case does?
Oh, absolutely, because it stands for the proposition that when you don't have all of the issues decided in a case, then you do not have an order that is a final appealable order. And I'm suggesting that that is not the case here. I'm suggesting that the case here is more reflective of Bell versus Mount Sinai Medical Center, where you did have all the issues decided. It was made pursuant to a special proceeding, and there was a substantial interest involved. What the city is asking for this morning from this court is that you make two determinations. We are first asking that this court determine that the Court of Appeals below did have jurisdiction to review the trial court's order because it was a final and appealable order. The city is also requesting that this court affirm the Court of Appeals' decision on the merits because the Court of Appeals, in vacating the trial court's order and reinstating the arbitration award, relied on a long history of well-reasoned labor cases, beginning with the Steelworkers Trilogy cases in the 1960s. I would submit to this court that there are some key facts that came out in the arbitration hearing that I'd like to highlight for you because I believe it would be important to your decision today. First of all, the arbitrator did find, and it was undisputed at the arbitration hearing, that the city has sole managerial responsibility for training its police officers. Second of all, it did come out, again, it was undisputed, that the city for 25 years has paid its police cadets at a training rate of pay and did not pay them at a higher rate until those cadets had, in fact, graduated and been sworn in as police officers.
Counsel, how do you explain the operative paragraph that seems to say after X number of weeks they bump up, the city says the big thing, big entity, somebody from the city agreed to that?
Justice Piper, I believe that.
After once you agree to that, past history of what you've been doing is out the window, isn't it? Aren't you contractually bound to follow contracts that you enter into? They're irrespective of past history.
Your Honor, that is not the case. The parties, by their practice, can in fact change the language in a collective bargaining agreement.
So you enter into agreement and you just go right on doing it the old way and say, hey, we're not going to honor these words, and unless our cadets sue us, negotiation of that paragraph is meaningless.
I'm suggesting to you, Your Honor, that that paragraph was put in there prior to any of the present parties even becoming representatives for the city or the union. What I'm suggesting is that paragraph referred to a procedure that simply was no longer in existence. The evidence in the text...
Then why agree to it? Why did the city agree to it?
Because at the time that it was implemented, and it is unclear from the record based on the city and the union, it's unclear when this section was first implemented, but at the time, it was implemented obviously because the city had, back in 1981, conducted a training session that consisted of 7.5 weeks. That's the only thing in the record that one can glean from to determine that this may have been referred to as a special expedited training program. However, the city has been conducting normal training academies for the next 16, 17 years. And the arbitrator...
And they're apparently not reading the agreements that they enter into.
Neither party was reading the agreement. I would suggest, and I agree with the arbitrator, that at some point, the parties both abandoned that section because it was no longer applicable to the yearly training sessions that were taking place in the city. It was not a special expedited training program. Therefore, I think that the arbitrator and the Court of Appeals also agreed that the arbitrator based his decision on the language of the collective bargaining agreement. He based on the conduct of the parties, and based on that determined that the city had not violated the collective bargaining agreement. The trial court exceeded its jurisdiction when it vacated that award, because under 2711, there was a very narrow process by which the trial court can review an arbitration award. You basically have to show that the arbitrator exceeded his authority in making the award, and that the arbitrator so imperfectly made the award that it was not final, it was not binding.
Counsel, I'm interested in how this is going to be. Say the parties abandoned this. One of the parties would be new recruits. Or can they not bring an action to recover pay to which they're entitled to? Can that only be brought by the
And the arbitrator also looked at the record, and it was decided that the union was not representing cadets. That was based on the union's own testimony.
So then, contractually, the person that can bring the action for being shortchanged is the new recruit. Now, how do new recruits who've never had a relationship with the city until they put their hand on the Bible, take the oath of office, and become a police cadet? They can't really wave off something they don't. So I'm not understanding how they waive off this privilege. What wonder that one way the city waived it off and the recruits, it's just tough luck. They didn't know about it.
Well, it's unclear from the record if Section 53 dealing with the special expedited training program even dealt with cadets as opposed to something called apprentices, which are police officers in various rankings once they become police officers. So, for all of these reasons, Section 53 was very unclear in terms of who it was supposed to protect, what the parties meant when it originally agreed to that section.
Well, but was it? Counsel, let me try it a different way, where Justice Pfeiffer is, I think, going. On page 2 of the appellant's brief, they say in part, when Appalee unilaterally extended the 109th Academy class for 3 weeks, it denied the trainees and so forth. I've seen in my days, particularly as a councilman, numerous police classes. We always set up a schedule on how long they would be in class, the training program. Lesson plans, we would know exactly what they were going to be instructed in the third week, and the fifth week they'd take their driving exam, and so on. How many weeks was this set up for to start with? Are they correct when they say you unilaterally extended it 3 weeks? Or was the original program 19 weeks?
The original training sessions had actually gradually increased, Your Honor.
No, I want to know when this class started. You had a whole, book, it was about that thick, and it tells you what you're going to do each week of the session, of the training period. And the 13th week, they're either going to go out on the street and direct traffic as their first, and we send them around the neighborhoods with another officer, a more senior officer on patrol. That either is going to happen in the 13th week or it's going to happen in the 16th week.
That's correct.
All right. Now, what did it say when you started it? Did it say that, in fact, that they were going to be 16 weeks, they were going to go out, or 19 weeks?
It said, actually, it was 17 weeks.
Why wouldn't I have guessed that?
And the...
All right. So you concede 2 weeks.
Who's conceding?
Well, if you say you agreed to 17 weeks... that the class was going to be 17 weeks. Section 53 says 16 weeks. So if you set it at 17 weeks, they're right that it should not have been 19 weeks.
Your Honor, I'm suggesting that Section 53 does not apply to regular training academies. Section 53 talks about a special expedited training program that is not the normal training academy that the city conducts.
Okay, but the normal training academy the city conducts would have a prepared lesson plan for a number of weeks.
That's correct.
And I asked you what those number of weeks are, and if they're 16, then it is an expedited class. If it's 19, then you're right. What does it show?
It shows in this particular case,
17 weeks. Okay.
And actually, it can be extended depending on the kind of training that the police cadets have to receive based on the state requirements. But what's important and what the arbitrator determined was that special expedited training program was nowhere explained in the collective bargaining agreement. The union could not explain what it was, and the city only has its point of reference in the fact that, again, some 15 years or so earlier, there had been one training session that was conducted for 17 and a half weeks. For all of those reasons, the arbitrator found that the special expedited training program in the collective bargaining agreement could not have referred to the normal training academy that is conducted by the city, which the union acknowledged was in the city's managerial purview. So the arbitrator, my time is up. May I please move to the conclusion? Thank you. For all the reasons I've stated, the city would request that this court affirm the Court of Appeals' decision.
Thank you, Ms. Milton. Mr. D'Angelo, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
Counselor, how long did the 108th class go?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I know that
you must have looked at that for this case. You would have had to look at that for this case.
Your Honor, the city has unilaterally increased the number of weeks in the academy. Although it says a maximum figure of 16 weeks, it's their decision as to how long it goes. They dictate whether it's 14, 15, 16, and then have gone beyond 17, 18, 19. They've done that on their own.
You don't know how many weeks the 108th class or the 107th class went?
Your Honor, there was testimony in the record to that. Quite frankly, I didn't focus on that because I didn't think it was material to the arguments that you made here. I would ask the court to consider, in support of my answer to an earlier question about propositions law number 2 and 3, that we just didn't like the decision the arbitrator did in fact rule on the section of the agreement. I'd ask the court to consider the fact that the city never argued arbitrability in this case. In other words, they could have said, Mr. Arbitrator, you can't even determine what section 53 means because this case is not arbitrable. There's no controversy before you. There's no section of the collective bargaining agreement that applies here. But that, in essence, is what the arbitrator ruled. He said that Section 53 does not exist. The city's position has evolved. At the arbitration proceeding, from the record that was submitted, they said that Section 53 is obsolete, and now we should follow the past practice between the parties. At the time of the hearing, they tried to throw in another argument that, well, the language special expedited training program, wait a minute, Section 53 pertains to something called a creature, not the police academy. We believe that their evolving position indicates that this arbitrator failed to interpret that section and to simply discard it. I would like to again direct your attention to the Stewart decision and point out that in the affidavit submitted to the center and the other arbitrator, both acknowledge that evidence was induced at hearing as to the loss of consortium plan. So there can be no dispute as to whether or not that evidence was considered by that particular panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.